Yes, thanks a lot for having me. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks to all of you for coming, for being here tonight. I myself would rather be in front of the TV at this moment, so I promise to keep it short, and then later on we can all go watch the TV and the events unfolding in Egypt right now, which actually is completely not unconnected to the phenomena I want to talk about today, namely tear gas and its relation to documentary representation, and especially its function as a marker of authenticity, or as I kind optimistically tried to phrase it, to experience, which will be the first part of my lecture, will be about this, to investigate the relation between tear gas or its representation and its relation to experience, whether anything like this exists or not. I completely got stuck with this attempt, as you will see, mainly because I didn't manage to figure out what experience actually means or how I could understand it, and then I decided to focus on something which seemed more manageable to me, namely the relation of tear gas to education. And that's the newer part of the talk. It's more recent research, and this will be the second part of the talk. Yes, so let's first go through the pictures which sort of formed the starting point for this investigation, which were pictures made by Alan Sekulow as part of a series called Waiting for Tear Gas back in 1999 during the protests against the top meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle. And as you all know, there were huge protests, and this became an iconic moment in the recent history of protest movements. And his series was called Waiting for Tear Gas. It was accompanied by a short text which he published alongside the pictures when they were published in book form. Usually they are shown as 81 color slides. And he described his, perspective when he produced this series in 1999. I hope to describe the attitudes of people waiting, unarmed, sometimes deliberately naked in the winter chill, for the gas and the rubber bullets and the concussion grenades. There were moments of civic solemnity, of urban anxiety and of carnival. Again, something very simple is missed by description of this as a movement founded in cyberspace. The human body asserts itself in the city streets against the abstractions of global capital. And let me just show you a few slides from this series. I mean, actually, these are not slides. These are various image files I picked up online mainly. I will come back to this later to show you what this series looked like. It was mainly observations from a series of demonstrations which very quickly turned into riots. And he also described his own attitude when photographing these events. He had a specific, protocol when making these pictures. My working idea was to move with the flow of protests from dawn to 3 a.m. if need be. The rule of thumb for this sort of anti-journalism, no flash, no telephoto lens, no gas mask, no autofocus, no press pass, and no pressure to grab at all costs the one defining image of dramatic violence. And the pictures that were thus produced, I would say many of them highlighted individuals such as this one, which were assuming often modest but sometimes also quite dramatic poses against a spectacle of state power, which appeared mostly in groups, faces masked by helmets and so on, basically faceless groups of people. And I think the whole setup both within the pictures themselves and within the description he gave of the pictures, as well as his protocol for making these pictures, can be said to construct a binary between the body of the protesters, which stands in the streets, sometimes even naked and unarmed, to resist what he calls the abstraction of global capital, which is represented by these groups of policemen, among others, who are obviously shooting tear gas canisters. And in many of the slides which involve, you know, tear gas being shot or being received, there is a feeling of heightened urgency, of course, a sort of a CNN news feeling, a feeling that at this point, at this moment, at the very moment tear gas is being dispersed, there is a individual and intense political experience going on, which is poised against the blind routine of police counterinsurgency measures. And so in these pictures, it seems that the experience of something else is indeed possible. And now I'm going to cut to something completely different, or to a completely different perspective, which is not an image at all, but a piece of text in which a tear gas cloud is being described. And this is a quote by Giorgio Agamben from his treatise Infancy and History, in which he describes basically the absence of experience in modernity or in the present times. So he describes a number of, let's say, events or incidents which are very mundane, like reading the newspaper or sitting for minutes on end at the wheel of a car in a traffic jam. Neither the subway nor a demonstration that suddenly blocks the streets nor a cloud of tear gas slowly dispersing between the buildings of the city center, nor even rapid blasts of gunfire, nor queuing up at a business counter, and so on and so on, none of these events will have become experience. So in my view, this is, let's say, this takes the opposite perspective. This says that not even something, an incident, which is very often seen, let's say, in political iconography to portray a very intense and authentic experience, political experience, an experience of resistance and maybe of uprising, not even that, in Agamben's view, is sufficient to create anything like experience. In fact, his main witness for this argument is, of course, Walter Benjamin, who wrote the text called The Storyteller, in which he famously declared that after World War I and the experiences that soldiers or human beings made within World War I, you know, the barrage and the onslaught of grenades and shells and this constant superhuman onslaught onto the senses, none of these incidents could actually be translated into experience. It couldn't be translated into a narrative. It couldn't be translated into a story that could be told and retold. This was absolutely impossible. And according to Benjamin, experience had been degraded, maybe, into something which in German he calls Erlebnis, which is something similar, but in a way more superficial, and I think it would be fair to translate it into spectacle in this context. So on the one hand, there would be an experience which could be translated into a narrative, into a story, into something which would, you know, enable some sort of personal growth and maturity, and on the other hand, there is a spectacle which provides an intense sensory. What does it provide? An agitation or an excitation, if you like, but not an experience. And this would be a spectacle which does not correspond to any classical notion of experience, which would include, and this is something which Agamben says later on in the text, to transform the personality to mature, and he's referring to Monseigneur. In relation to that, there's actually an interesting twist which Agamben himself doesn't develop, and which I do not develop as either, but I think that's the most interesting part, because he hints at the fact that perhaps humans cannot make experiences in any of these situations, but actually objects or machines can, because the only, you know, thing he considers capable of an experience is actually a camera, which, you know, records perceptions or sensations instead of the human beings, and this thus potentially is able to make an experience. This is something which I find very interesting. So we have these two almost... this is a crazy example. I'm just going to show it to you very briefly, just because it's so weird. This is actually something which might or might not fall into Agamben's description. It's a person who has developed a perfume called Revolution, which is based on the smell of smoke, tear gas, and gasoline, and which acts as an olfactory critique on contemporary luxury branding and political impossibility. Surprisingly, it smells really good. This is the advertisement. The bottle is supposed to look like a pipe bomb, and it costs $40,000. This person traveled the world to interview 10 living revolutionaries. The memories of the smell of rebellion, blood, decaying flesh, smoke, and burnt rubber were transformed into a fragrance, and so on. As I said, it cost between $4,000 and $40,000 US dollars, and it's supposed to smell really good. So that's the other, other possible instance in which tear gas even is becoming a commodity, essentially. So now we have two completely opposite perspectives on tear gas. One is that it goes along with a potential political experience. The other, that it denotes precisely the complete impossibility of having any experience whatsoever. And what I would like to show now is an example which tries to, I would say, establish a relation between both of these different perspectives, and which tries to point at the interrelation between both experience and spectacle in relation to tear gas. And that's the film, that's an example from the film Medium Cool, which was made by Haskell Wexler in 1968 already, which is a very interesting film because it's actually a fiction film which has two main protagonists, one of which is a news journalist, a news cameraman, who follows the actual events of that period. And thus, most of the film, or a lot of the film, is set in front of real events, the main of which is the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968. And the whole end of the film is set within an actual riot. So you have the actors performing within an actual riot, which is going on in the background. And not only the last scene, but also other very important scenes are set within real situations, one of which is a training sequence in which the National Guard trains on how to deal with protesters. And that's a very interesting scene because the protesters are also being played by policemen, and there's a very interesting police theater going on where police tries to get the so-called protesters under control, and fake tear gas is also being sprayed all over the place. But the riot at the end is real. It's, so to speak, the thing which the police has been rehearsing, or the event which the police has been rehearsing. But as we will see, reality and spectacle and fiction are completely merged in this film. And I will show you a very brief clip now from a part which is close to the end, in which we will actually see how a real tear gas grenade is fired towards the film crew. And this has become a very famous scene because actually what's supposed to happen in this scene is, of course, the main character in the yellow dress moving through this real riot, but then again a real tear gas grenade being fired at the film crew and somebody, you know, a member of the crew screaming from off screen, "Look out, Haskell," which is the name of the director of the film. It's real, and many things have obviously been said about that incident, including, you know, the interpretation that this was indeed some sort of classical V effect in which the construction of the fictionality of the film itself is being revealed, and so on and so on, and that the reality of the film's production was being revealed by the intrusion, sudden explosion of this tear gas grenade. But the story is much more interesting, actually, and also a little bit more complicated. And I will show you now a clip from a TV documentary, which is a making of Medium Cool.
We need to switch the sound.
Yeah.
In war zones. And Haskell said, "Yeah, let's go get a drink." And we went and we got a drink and we never went back.
I mean, it was so unreal to be sitting down in the street in a major city in the United States of America and having these tanks come at you. Also, the juxtaposition of the real stuff that was going on while I was playing a part. It was just such an odd feeling knowing that the character that I was portraying wasn't me. When I talked to the cops, it wasn't me. So I was playing a part in a make-believe story in a real situation.
The Army National Guard were rehearsed in a fighting mode. And that's what they used in the streets of Chicago. Even when there was no attack, there was no offensive behavior, there was no violence directed at them, they still reacted as they were trained to react. And the film juxtaposed those two episodes, the National Guard getting ready for violence and the demonstrators being peaceful, and then projected it into the reality of what happened in the streets in Chicago.
When Haskell had shot the sequence at Fort Ripley, the National Guard training, they were using fake tear gas. Those canisters were spraying out a white powder, and Haskell was moving right in among people and going in for close-ups, and you can see Bob Forster in for a close-up without tear gas protection because it's just talcum powder. Haskell was standing shooting a line of National Guardsmen, and one of them actually fired his tear gas canister at Haskell and the crew as part of the frustration and back off, guys.
Look out, Haskell, it's real!
It was real, and I was tear gassed with Jonathan Hayes, my producer and friend.
I don't know if you've ever been tear gassed, but particularly that scene on gas is, you know, when you think about tear gas, well, you think, well, it makes you cry, it makes you uncomfortable. It makes you think you're going to die. because you can't breathe and your skin burns like hell. I have to tell you that the line, "Look out, Haskell, it's real," was done afterwards, you know. And I put it in because we were not shooting sound. But it was my intention and it was on my mind. I mean, if someone read my mind at the moment I was shooting and if the fucking tear gas was coming at me in slow motion, something in me said those very words.
It made a very important point about a nice commentary on that wonderful dichotomy that the film sits on, that razor edge of what's real, what's not real, what's fiction, and what's the context of that fiction, and how far does that context go? That all those issues that the film tried to raise were nicely crystallized for, you know, a little bit by that one line. So of course we used it, even though it was fake.
So, I mean, it's very obvious what happened in the film. The moment when the fiction is supposed to be interrupted, you know, by reality and explosion of... It's actually not a tear gas canister, I found out when I really played it back in slow motion. At that time, they had flamethrowers from World War II, which were redeveloped to be to dispense tear gas. So that's what actually happened in this scene. But what I was going to say, it's very obvious, the V effect is pure fiction, and the interruption of reality is, so to speak, the utmost spectacle. And that creates a quite interesting perspective on the relation of staging and spectacle. They are not external to the riot. You know, all along the film, people are screening to the TV cameras. Actually, the whole world is watching. They are staging themselves. They are on a stage. They are creating the scene, which is made for the TV cameras, of course, as something which is both fiction and reality. It's both experience and spectacle. And one could say that the militant, or even the filmmaker in this case, has a press pass. He has an autofocus and he has a gas mask, but it doesn't make, you know, the scene any less real or inauthentic. So it's probably something maybe like this. This is also an image I like to show. An image which was created collectively in a riot in Thessaloniki. Also in the background you see some tear gas dispersing, but instead of a protest, you know, banner, somebody is holding up this sign which says any similarity to actual persons or events is unintentional, which is actually the line which is always added on to the credits of any fiction film in order not to infringe, you know, somebody's personality rights. And this person was moving, you know, through the whole riot and trying to stick it into the TV cameras, which she did not actually. The TV cameras were not very interested in that banner, one has to say. They were more interested in the other parts of the staging that was going on at that time. So this is the prior research which is connected or was connected to the relation of tear gas to experience and got stuck with the fact that it was completely impossible to define what experience was in the first place. So I took a step back and asked myself, what is tear gas and how was it created and what, let's say, political geography does it define? And from this, let's say, reflection, I came to think about the relation of tear gas and education, which seemed to me a question which was more manageable than the first one. So how is tear gas both tied to education and to warfare? That's an interesting question. And how was tear gas developed in the first place? That's quite interesting. It was developed by the French police, who in 1912 started developing a chemical incapacitant, as it was called, and they developed it for a very special occasion, for the occasion to or they wanted to investigate means of action against what they called barricaded evildoers. Now, what is that? I read that on Wikipedia. I was immediately fascinated. Who could those barricaded evildoers have been? And that's actually a very interesting question, because it was developed after a very specific incident, the hunt for the members of the so-called Bono gang. Who is the Bono gang? The Bono gang was a gang of anarchist bank robbers who operated in 1911 and 1912. And they were workers connected to the so-called illegalist milieu, which was an anarchist, milieu, which advocated the reappropriation of private property, meaning all sorts of robberies and thefts, as a means of political action. And the members of this gang were associated to the editorial board of a newspaper, which was called Anarchie, in which, you know, the claims of the illegalist movement were voiced. And they had a very interesting relation to technology, because they were extremely tech-savvy. I mean, now it seems to us pretty outdated, but they used cars, you know, in order to commit the bank robberies, and they were the first ones to do it. They used repeating rifles. This was also cutting-edge technology at that time. And even one of the members of the gang sent his fingerprint defiantly to the French police, you know, to sort of sign off his act. But the thing was that the French police didn't even use fingerprinting as a means of authentication at that moment. So they were very, very capable of using new technology for their activities. And eventually, the gang was captured in two subsequent events. In the first event, the leader of the gang, Bono himself, was captured with a colleague and circled out in his hideout in Choisy-le-Roi. And then a long siege began, in which the chief of police even participated in person. And a huge crowd concentrated on that scene. There were 300 policemen, there were 800 soldiers, including a platoon of Zouaves. It was a colonial French army section, which brought with them a brand new machine gun. There were thousands of spectators, hundreds of them armed, which were ready to take the law into their own hands. And then there were two people inside the building, which showed up every now and then on the open-air staircase and fired a few shots, and then they retreated again. And in a description of this siege, it's being said that after a while, Bono lost interest in the attackers and withdrew to write his will, which is very long and very literary, and mainly concentrated on emphasizing his own celebrity status. So about one page, he goes on about pointing out to the police that he became a famous star, whereas the police, were sort of quite obscure individuals. And this he wrote during the siege, which eventually was ended when the chief of police brought in dynamite and exploded the whole building. And by that point in time, already the film cameras were on that scene as well, so that the end of the siege is posted on YouTube at that moment now. So, I mean, you have to imagine, it went on for hours and hours. It almost took a whole day, the siege, so the camera crews had plenty of time, you know, to set up their gear in front of the hideout. These are descriptions of bullets which are flying through the air, and so on and so on. So this is actually the bomb or the dynamite charge. And you see even the horse is moving backwards because there are bullets flying possibly from the other side. I mean, who knows? And now there's an explosion. and the whole house is being brought down at the end, and both bandits are captured. Bono, even alive, he still manages to fire a few bullets at the chief of police. And then he dies. This is a contemporary representation of the event. This is probably the chief of police shooting at Bono, who has wrapped himself in a mattress in order to soften the effects of the explosion. So it's very obvious why the French police at that moment felt the need to develop some incapacitating agent which would help them deal with this kind of event from a distance. And that's also what they did. They developed it very swiftly within a year. It was in use already. That was in 1913. But then it became immediately also used in World War I. And that's something which is not very well known, that actually tear gas is the first chemical weapon to have been used in World War I, way before other chemical weapons such as mustard gas and so on were used. And even later on, it continued to be used because it was supposed to make people take their gas masks away in order to rub their eyes so that the other gases could take effect. And so the French used it first during World War I, and the German army also used tear gas, and all of them used other chemical weapons later on. And this is my boarding pass. This actually, the military use of tear gas created a legal situation which is actually quite paradoxical and also very interesting, because after World War I, people simply tried to prohibit any use of chemical weapons in any sort of armed conflict unless to minimize the risk of escalation to full-scale chemical warfare. So no riot control agent, including tear gas, no chemical agent at all is permitted in military conflict or in war, but they are permitted, paradoxically, for law enforcement. Meaning, you can use tear gas inside a country or under any sort of national jurisdiction. You can use it against, so to speak, the own citizens. But you can't use it in a military conflict. You can't use it beyond a border. And thus, a very interesting form of political geography is created in which tear gas actually reacts to political borders, but paradoxically could also be created, used to create political borders, meaning wherever tear gas is, so to speak, the inside of any political situation, not the outside. And that becomes pretty clear in the next example that was brought to my attention by Eyal Weizmann, which describes describes an incident in which one Palestinian protester was called next to the separation wall in 2009, and the whole investigation was about finding out whether a tear gas canister had been shot at this person directly, which seems to have happened, and he died basically from the impact, or whether it was shot in a legally, let's say, proper manner, which would have been to have an angle of 60 degrees pointing upwards so that the impact would have been softened. I'm not going to go into details concerning that investigation. It was all about finding out the angle of the shooting, firing off of that tear gas grenade, and to find out whether it had been, so to speak, a legal use of tear gas or not. But on the other hand, the legality of this use is also complicated by the fact that it is very difficult to determine whether, in this case, tear gas had been shot across a border or not. And obviously, according to the Israeli authorities, this is an internal and thus legal use of tear gas. But the interesting thing is, of course, that by the use of tear gas, the blurring, you know, of inside and outside is being made very apparent, and the blurring of police action and military action. And this is actually already the case in the example of the Bono gang, which I mentioned, in which both the army and the police cooperate in bringing down these individuals. This is a historical picture which shows the army forces being deployed in another siege in which other members of the gang are being trapped and eventually killed. And other examples of military uses of tear gas include the Vietnam War, in which tear gas was deployed to drive the Viet Cong from the tunnels, and then they would be shot when they emerged. And another very interesting and paradoxical example is the use of tear gas in Iraq, but not now, already in 2003, by George W. Bush, which created a discussion whether that use of tear gas was actually violating the Chemical Weapons Convention in Iraq or not, and that might have enabled Saddam Hussein, paradoxically, to retaliate and to develop his own chemical weapons in response. So what does all of this have to do with education? And I want to come back to the topic. There is a so-called internal or legal use of tear gas, which is called less lethal weapon, a non-lethal or less lethal weapon. And this seems to provide some sort of pedagogical benefit for the people who are being treated with this. It seems to be a pedagogy, essentially, for the lower classes to conform, you know, to what is expected from them. And I think the example of the Bono gang, against whom the tear gas has been developed in the first place, is a very interesting example, because the members of this gang left many written testimonies in which they describe their desire to be educated and to read books and to get a proper education, and they say how over and over again they were not able to get an education because, of course, of their social conditions and because they had to work and it simply didn't work out. So in that sense, one could say that tear gas was a sort of alternative education in that case. And the external use of tear gas is prohibited because it's classified as a chemical weapon. So the interesting thing is that one has to conclude that tear gas is, in fact, a kind of education, and this is completely regardless of the fact whether it's an experience or not, whether it relates to spectacle or not. It is a kind of education, and I think one has to even radicalize that statement and has to say and emphasize that tear gas is not only an education, but in many cases also dispensed instead of an education, instead of what we know as an education. And when education systems are being dismantled, tear gas is being offered as a form of alternative education. And one should not dismiss that, but take that seriously, because this form of education is actually nothing new. It is very resonant with all colonial violence administered on colonial subject, and also developed to keep the dangerous classes who defy private property under control. And it enables, you know, the forces of law to capture them without necessarily killing them or being in the danger of being killed. And if one were to look into that closer, one would certainly find out that this form of education is developed in parallel and as a sort of supplement to the forms of education that we think of as education, education in schools and universities, and an education which is developed to cater to the people like the members of the Bono gang, who, as I said, were not able to get a formal and proper education. And as such, I want to conclude that tear gas is actually a real education and should be taken seriously as such. And I went immediately online when I had this idea to check whether anybody else would agree with me or whether that was just too crazy. And actually, I found one single person who did agree with me, who was an old activist historian called Jesse Lermisch. And he said he's an historian, and he cheerfully declared that a good dose of tear gas makes us think more clearly as historians. So he, he analyzed that as a sort of intensifier. Anyhow, the interesting thing is, where did he learn that? And that brings us back to the earlier example I showed. And he's writing somewhere else that his capacity to understand the terror and fight involved in 18th century crowd control was enhanced by the experience of being in a crowd that was tear-gassed and nearly blinded by Chicago Mayor Daley's police on Michigan Avenue in August 68. And these are exactly the scenes that we have seen already in the film Medium Cool, because these are the same scenes that formed the backdrop for this film, Medium Cool, and formed also the stage for the shooting of that, that dose of tear gas. And now I think it becomes clear that it makes no difference whatsoever how fictional or artificial or inauthentic or permeated by capital any experience / spectacle is, because it can be turned into an education, if you like. It doesn't matter, you know, whether Haskell Wexler recorded his statement in the sound studio or not. It doesn't matter whether he had a press pass when he shot his scenes. It wouldn't even matter if he had fired off that dose of tear gas himself. The point is that the tear gas seems to have worked as an education, at least for this person here called Jesse Lermisch. So to come back again to the beginning of my lecture, and Alan Sekula's slides and the tension between experience and spectacle that seems to be expressed, at least in my reading, in those slides. Because, interestingly enough, he establishes this kind of binary divide between his anti-journalistic slides on the one hand, which are, you know, taken from the point of view of the protester without any gas masks or press passes or anything that would liken them to products of commercial journalism, which are clearly located on the other hand. Journalistic or media commodities are, let's say, the products that these slides do not want to be at any costs. But the interesting thing is that, in my view, this opposition collapses within the way that these pictures present themselves to us, in the material consistence of these image files, actually, because these are the only image files which are publicly accessible online. And the interesting thing is that they are very, very degraded. I would say even exceptionally degraded. If you look at that example, very, very pixelated. And this is something which I have encountered over and over again when researching Sekula's work online. So the reason is, of course, that these pictures are owned and represented by commercial galleries who will very much degrade the previews online because they want to sell the real thing as a commodity. And, I mean, the real thing sort of looks like that, which is a photo which I took from a catalog. The catalogs are also very expensive, but this is how the pictures would look like in full resolution. So the interesting thing is that in the material composition of how the pictures present themselves to us, at least here in this forum or online, capital is already deeply described into this picture. Into their resolution, into the way they look and present themselves to us. But my final point is that, again, it doesn't make any difference because it doesn't affect their educational value at all. So the final point is maybe that experience may be opposed to spectacle or not, but education, it doesn't matter. For education, it doesn't matter whether it's made in the mode of experience or in the mode of spectacle. Education is possible in the mode of spectacle, perhaps not an experience in the way that Benjamin Agamben would have defined it, but an education can be had not only in spite of its spectacular conditions, but precisely because of them. Thank you.